points within Agenda Paper 5 that we'd like to explore a little bit more with you. These are areas where I think some of the examples that we've used, we've talked about things that are quite clearly identifiable as being allowable within the regulations. So items, we've talked about the pass-through costs, where they're very specific items that are quite clearly identifiable. But we also then touched on some of the one-off type of costs. And one of the things that we're particularly interested in is how clear it is in the regulation where if you have something that is a one-off cost, is there something, or a one-off event, I should say, rather than just a one-off cost, but I appreciate the one-off costs are probably the most common example. But if something happens that's not explicitly referred to within the regulation, what we're interested in is how do you address the uncertainty if as a preparer you feel it's something that should lead to a rate adjustment? What is it that gives you the I don't want to say ammunition because it sounds like you're in conflict, but what is it that gives you the information that you need to submit a request to the regulator to say, you know, we want a rate adjustment. We know it's not specifically mentioned in the regulation, but we think it's a reasonable request to make. What sort of evidence do you use to support that that situation? And you know, we're interested also in the timing of that. If you obviously you can't do a pre-approval request for that, it's going to be post-approval. But particularly if you're at your reporting period end, your year end, and you haven't yet had chance to have the discussion with the regulator, how do you actually deal with that in terms of reporting for statutory purposes as well as for regulatory purposes when you're submitting your returns?
Let's start with Michelle.
Sure, I'm going to take two questions out of your question. It's probably the first one, what source of uncertainty do you face in making your assessment? I believe the issue normally, it's not whether the item would be recovered, but it's the timing of the recovery. Is it going to be over 3 years or over 5 years? Because the size of the amount, you know, may have a rate shock. So the regulator may say, well, spread it over 10 years, although you may want to do it over 5 years. It's more of a timing issue as opposed to whether the item can be recovered. The other source of uncertainty is whether or not the regulator will decide that cost is not prudently incurred. So that could also be an issue, you know, from time to time. The other question was the evidence. What type of evidence do you obtain to make your assessment? There's a number of issues of places. The first one is that if the regulator for your pass-through, they will have given you an account number. They said all those debits and credit goes on those numbers. So that's pre-approved.
Yeah.
Simple. If you look at the one-off, you could look at the rate decision that have been granted to other in the industry. If it's worked for one, it should work for you. The regulator in Ontario, they have the FAQs, the frequently asked questions, so they will provide you enough information about what can be and what cannot be recovered. There would be written board orders and directives provided by the regulator. And often, I see when the amounts are large, they will engage legal counsel that will provide also support to the entity to recognize those regulatory assets and liabilities. So that's those two questions.
Thank you. Richard?
I have a real-life example of the one-off that Jane just talked about. I won't go through the evidence that Michelle just talked about because we did go through all of those things in determining what we should do about it. But we had a situation where the regulator had approved us to go ahead and build a transmission line between Edmonton and Calgary. And we had spent $35 million. And then the regulator, because of something that they had done, and I won't get into all of the details here, they terminated the project. So what we had to figure out was how much were we going to show as a regulatory asset? How much were we going to be able to recover from all of this? There was three components to this. The first was the $35 million that we had spent. The second was $9 million of financing over the period of time that we had spent that money. And the third item was about $5 million worth of tax implications. So in total, we're talking about $50 million, pretty close to $50 million. And as the controller, I had to decide how much of that I was going to show as an asset. So I went, I did my homework, as Michelle just talked about, look at the various precedents and so on. And I came to the conclusion that we should show the $35 million because we had spent it, and the likelihood is we were going to recover it. Secondly, that we should show the $9 million of financing costs, because again, we had to incur those costs in order to spend the $35 million. So I was comfortable with showing that amount as a receivable. I was not comfortable with the tax component because it was quite complex and I wasn't sure that our arguments would be sufficient. We had a separate application that we put to the regulator where this specific item was talked about. I was on the stand defending the numbers that I've just talked about, and we were actually successful, surprised at myself, we were successful in getting all three components. So we recovered all of it, but I had only reflected the first two components in our records because I wasn't sure we recovered the third part.
Duane? I think very similar to what Michelle and Richard have said, we have what we call our hierarchy of considerations in terms of, you know, how confident are we that this is a good asset. And, you know, if you have explicit legislation or explicit order, obviously that's most confident. If you have experience yourself with that regulator in similar circumstances, that'd be the next level. If there are other entities within your jurisdiction, like in the state of Illinois, other entities that have received similar treatment, that's another consideration. Much less down the confidence scale is other jurisdictions, like state of Indiana, do they do this or not? But that's really kind of not that relevant. Each state has their own authority. So we will look at that as a hierarchy in terms of determining the probability that something will be allowed. As you know, in the U.S., as I mentioned, we use 75% as our threshold at Exelon for probability. That's a judgment, obviously, and it's based on those considerations. We will often, I think Michelle mentioned, we will also look to regulatory counsel to do legal letters if we really feel something's uncertain, to have their perspective as to what they think might happen based on past experience in that jurisdiction, et cetera. In the regulatory filings, obviously you're going to ask for it, so in the filing itself, but in the annual reporting or the monthly reporting to the regulator, rather, periodic reporting, we typically will follow GAAP as our starting point for them as well and use the same criteria.
Okay, so that gives you a difference then between your annual reporting, if there's a gap then before your formal rate
before
filing.
We do the ask, if you will. Okay.
Michael? You're good?
No, he took it.
Yeah, I'm taking it back.
Oh, okay. So, Michelle,
I'd like to address the other two questions in your paper about the demand risk. And that was an interesting one because out of the five submissions that I've received from our utilities in Canada, all of them put not applicable, which is interesting.
Which one, Michelle?
Demand.
Oh, I was going to cover that too. Go ahead.
And I was a bit surprised. I said, it is applicable, but I don't think they understood, you know, or what it means demand risk. And it's one of the, it's the third criteria under US GAAP that you need to be in order to be in the in ASC 980, you need to make sure that your costs would be able to be recovered, taking into account the demand risk. But that being said, you know, there's a few things that maybe they don't see that as a big deal because most of the regulatory assets and liabilities will be short-term in nature. And really, over 3 years, I'm going to stretch it 5 years. It's a long period for a regulator. There are some that over that, but they're very limited. These are the ones that have been approved by the regulator. You've got also the other ones that are created by accounting difference. Let's call it the cash versus accrual basis for your deferred taxes. You recover your taxes on a cash basis, not on an accrual basis. So that difference will be creating a regulatory asset that is not necessarily approved by the regulator, but that's going to be over a longer period. So that could be an issue for that. But they didn't think about it to that perspective. But the ones that are approved to me that are short term, There are some that I understand are coming that may be triggered on a much longer, I've even heard before yesterday, 70 years for a recovery of an impaired asset.
You said 70?
70, 70. I was like, holy moly, you know? And you say you don't have a demand risk?
Yeah. But anyhow. Finance, you ain't gonna been that long.
You can't retire.
You can't retire.
So, Michelle, in that case, I'm sorry to interject, but in that case, we typically, anything over 15 years, right, we typically will not set up a direct asset.
That's what I want to say.
Yeah.
I would stop after 20 years.
It's very rare that you're in that situation, but we have it as a matter of policy. If it's over 15 years, we do not believe we meet the probability threshold to say we
can vote
it. And we look at it from that standpoint when they come in. I have not seen one that was over 15 years, but yet alone 70. That's a stretch.
70.
Yeah, that wouldn't get regulatory asset treatment in the United States.
50 or 15?
-15 is our policy.
His is -15.
And yours is 15 as well, or 50?
No,
15. Both of them are 15.
Yeah. Dara, do you have a?
And maybe while Dwayne's still got his sober own up, and possibly for Richard too, just listening to what you were saying, couple of questions that came out of that. The first is there a typical practice, if you do have uncertainty about perhaps a big number, to approach the regulator during the course of the year to clarify? Secondly, we've talked about 15 years and 20 years and 70 years and et cetera, but I presume that it's quite soon after the expenses incurred that you have certainty as to the acceptance by the regulator of the expense. So how frequently does that happen? Does your regulatory year typically follow your financial year? So are you sort of seeing a correspondence between those two? And then the last one is, do these regulatory agreements typically include some sort of arbitration arrangement? So there's some option to argue your case before going to court.
Yes, so a lot of questions. And let me take the last one first. In the U.S., at least, there are very structured procedural rules that each jurisdiction has, and then there's also recourse to the courts. But within the first case, or the actual proceeding, there are, and Brian probably speaks better of this than me, but there are all, you have the company, you have the staff, and the commission, and then you have interveners. So all people have a right to provide their perspective around the company's request or the regulator's request. If the regulator calls you in for a rate decrease, that came up earlier, that can happen. So there's a very structured proceeding around that. Then if the parties want to appeal that decision to the court system, then it goes through the courts. So that was your first question. The
regulated year versus financial year? Are they typically the same calendar period?
The financial reporting requirements are typically a calendar year basis. You can file rates based on a test year. So you will say, here's a snapshot of my costs for 12 months. You can either do a historical-looking test year for what my costs were last year. Sometimes commissions allow you to do a future-looking test year to try to eliminate regulatory lag where you have inflation, but the rates don't get put in place for a year, for instance. That can be any 12-month period as a representative snapshot of what your cost structure is. So that's not necessarily aligned with the calendar year, if that's what you were asking.
And then how quickly after, let's say, the end of a financial year, do you get regulatory certainty about whether something's approved or not? Or does that wait until the end of a five-year period? So how long is that uncertainty?
Very much depends on the temporary difference in question. Michael was talking about incentive rates that maybe have a five-year look back. Hey, we'll give you rates, let's look at what you did for 5 years and then come back and settle. Other ones are monthly. We have purchase gas adjustments or purchase energy adjustments that we're truing it up monthly. So every mechanism and every temporary difference has its own structure around it, so it can vary significantly.
And then the last one is, to the extent that you perhaps have a significant unexpected incurred cost, can you typically approach the regulator up front and say, look, I need certainty on what the outcome is likely to be, or do you just fit in within the framework? The regulator doesn't typically do that.
We typically have ongoing normal conversations with our regulators, and so you do get some sense. But again, until you go through the full proceeding, there will be many interveners that may have a totally different perspective, although the staff's perspective is probably the most likely to be the one to carry the day. But again, how long does that take? It kind of depends as well. Sometimes a regulator will tell you, go ahead and defer this stuff for regulatory reporting, and we'll come back to it later to tell you what we really think. That puts a lot of, you know, for me as a preparer, then it's like, okay, well, they said go ahead and defer it, but for GAAP, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. It just means for them, they just said, well, capture those costs in one place, and we'll tell you later whether you get them or not. So I have to often remind my staff, well, just because they said defer it doesn't mean it meets our probability threshold. That's kind of a different decision. And that happens. I don't know if that's responsive or not.
But, like, will people make special out-of-cycle filings because of damage from Harvey and Irma?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep.
And how often for just mega or
just what?
Mega events? Or
they can do it just much for anything. It doesn't necessarily, it's about cost-driven.
Yeah, I don't know that it happens that often, though.
It doesn't. With the advent of formula rates, when we're looking at the rate every year, it's really kind of like real-time. So you don't see those interim things, because we look at the rate every year, and all the interveners and all the parties are involved at that particular point. But certainly, during that period, we just had the storms down in Florida, so it did happen when we had that mega storm where the company came in for a recognized treatment for storm damages, but we already deliberated those before, so they got their relief.
Yeah. I mean, Illinois, we don't have hurricanes, so we don't have that structure. In Florida, they already have that all prearranged. If you're going to have a big hurricane, the general rule is you'll get 3 years recovery. Just come in and let us look at the cost to make sure they were prudent.
Right. Michael? Just to pick up, I think, on a couple of those. So in terms of sort of arbitration or process, when you get, you know, if you get to the end of a price, you're not comfortable, it's very structured. You know, within the mechanisms, you know, appeal process on both sides, and the UK ultimately the company can take the CMA. So that is the year end one. Typically, your financial reporting year end will time with the regulatory reporting interest because it's easier. So in the UK, the regulatory year is 31 March. However, what you do find is if you've got multinational groups, it gets a bit tricky because you know you might have a US parent with a UK utility or a UK parent with a US utility, 31 December reporting, 31 March regulatory year end in the UK. So you will find on a group-wide basis, on a multinational basis, disconnects between the group financial reporting year end, following accounts, and the regulatory periods in each country.
Thank you. Richard?
Our year end was We ran from May until April, and everybody else who reported to the regulator was on a calendar year, and so they made us change so that we were on a calendar year along with everybody else. So now they're both the same. With regard to some of the other questions, can you approach the regulator at any time? Yes, you can. It may or may not be a big thing. For example, there was one utility in Edmonton, and they had just gone through their rate application for the next 3 years. They had received approval for it, and within a month of getting approval, they then went back to the regulator and said they wanted to change one item. This is a big item, but they wanted to change one item that was in there, and that they had figured out a way to save quite a bit of money for their customers. And the regulator said, no, we've already approved what you're going to do for the next 3 years. If you want to go ahead and do that, that's fine, but you do it on your own dime. We're not going to pay for that, or we're not going to allow you to change what has already been approved from a regulatory perspective. But you can go to them at any time and about any item that you want to go to. And as Duane said, there's somebody else that you've got to think about in all of this, and that's the interveners. They play a very important part in this, at least within Canada they do. And so what you've got to do is you've got to keep them involved. So if you've got something that has come up and you intend to go before the regulator to get their approval, they will always hold a public meeting to discuss that. Even if it's not, it could be a written proceeding as opposed to an oral proceeding, but either way, the interveners will get involved. So it's always a good idea to at least sit down with them and talk to them. You might not get them on site. They may still not like the idea that you're trying to put forward, but at least you've let them know what it is you're proposing and why. And then when you go into the actual hearing itself, you've got some idea of what they're going to say about it. Are they going to support you, or are they going to be against you?
Thank you.
Michelle. In Ontario, the rate is set, not the rate, sorry, the when you go for your rate application, it's going to be either for 2 years, I think transmission is 2 years, others could be 3 years, others could be 5 years, but you are allowed, you know, every year to go for true-up of certain costs and ask, you know, a decision on that. And one of the other thing, I think that's what you said, but I just want to confirm, I believe that you could also get the approval, not the approval, a letter from the staff, the regulator staff as opposed to the board. It's not binding, but you can say to the staff, what do you think, you know, if I include that? They can give you a letter, but it's gonna, not going to be binding, but it's going to certainly help you to make your assessment, you know.
Yeah, I don't think that's interesting. I don't think I've ever seen one where the staff would put themselves out.
We will not do that.
They don't in the U.S.
We
can talk to them.
And we have pre-filing meetings and stuff like that when we bring on the parties.
Michael, do you want to come here again?
I hope so. Not actually that time.
Can I then ask one more question then? Just we've talked a little bit about probabilities and how you assess high probability and et cetera. If you assess something, I'm assuming at the moment, if you assess something as, I think you said 75% is the, so if you assess something as 70%, you would recognize zero. If you assess something as 76%, would you recognize the whole amount, or would you sort of risk weight it and recognize 76%?
No, we recognize the entire amount.
Okay. And do you have a distinction between the way you recognize an asset and a liability in that, or would you recognize both of them using exactly the same criteria?
Pretty much the same criteria, the same threshold as well. The 75% is what we use. It's pretty much the same criteria.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you. Any additional comments, Peter?
Well, I was just a bit puzzled on that last one, really, actually, because I'd always thought that maybe for the liability it would be kind of the converse, and that you would say that by not booking the liability, implicitly you're sort of assuming a recovery, and so maybe if you've got a 75% threshold for the asset, you'd have a 25% threshold for the liability. That's the way I would think about it.
An asset means additional revenue. A liability would mean you're refunding revenue, if you will. So I don't know that there is a complement there.
But the other thing is, you've got to be careful in the regulatory setting that you haven't got a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if you sit down and you put a liability onto your books, whether it's from regulatory or GAAP purposes, people are going to ask you about it, say, what's this all about? And you might as well just send them the check at the same time. So that's part of the
thought that goes into it. That makes my job hard, but to your point, Richard, though, but as you know, it's probable we're going to give it back. I have to book it.
Then you got it. You
don't regardless know politically what that means.
Right. But you've got your pass through, which is negative sometimes. So that one you have no choice. You have to book it.
And presumably that probability, you do that on a cumulative basis. You don't look at each one individually. Presumably you just look at the total that you're
individual. I think that's why your 75-25 doesn't work, is because you're actually accumulating individual assets and individual liabilities.
It's individual item by item.
Okay. Could I just ask a question about more PP&E related or asset base related? Because I was just slightly nervous with the 15-year cut-off, knowing that a lot of you are in industries where you have very long life infrastructure assets. And it kind of triggered a question as to how differently the regulator may treat the infrastructure assets compared to the GAAP treatment of those regulatory assets, and what differences might arise there. And part of the reason for asking that question is that I know under Topic 980 under US GAAP, and I understand, I think, something similar in Canadian GAAP, where once the regulator has approved that PP&E amount, then that's the amount that effectively goes into your GAAP financial statements, so you don't need to worry about any differences. But that was a very unpopular part of the earlier exposure draft from the board. A lot of the comments coming back was, you know, that's not very transparent. It's hard to then see what the differences are between the regulatory numbers and the normal GAAP numbers, if you like. And I was just wondering, therefore, you know, if we were to go down the line of trying to keep them separate, as we had done in IFRS 14, where we say that the PP&E number needs to be the IFRS number, and then there's a regulatory balance created for any differences between the regulatory numbers and the GAAP numbers. Those could flow over quite a long period of time, and I don't know whether anybody has got any experience of that if you're not using IFRS 14, or what thoughts you might have where, you know, I think, I can't remember who it was now, maybe Michelle, who mentioned some accounting differences rather than differences that need approving, and whether you'd have a different attitude to those.
Well, from a PP&E perspective, one of the differences that occurs to me is the difference between AFUDC calculated using the regulatory approach and CBC calculated using the IFRS approach. Typically, there is a difference there, and you'll typically what you'll have is a receivable and asset that you would, a regulatory asset that you will have created, and that's a receivable that will be recovered over a long period of time. So it seems to fit exactly the situation that you're talking about. And we did have that, and we set those items up as long-term receivables. That I don't know that you can see them, because I don't know that the amounts were big enough to warrant separate disclosure in AltaLink's financial statements, but they're certainly in there in terms of the numbers are in there, and then part of the disclosure around what's in the numbers.
Sorry, what was CBC?
CBC is capitalized borrowing costs. So that's the IFRS term, as opposed to the regulatory term.
No, they've just put the flag as that. So Michelle.
That's one of the questions I've asked the utilities last week. I said, which war do you want me to fight for you, and which one, you know, you can let go? let's be honest. And that one, they said, well, you know what, we're all applying IFRS 14, so having those differences in a separate account, we are fine, except for one entity, because they have utilities in the U.S. that they are consolidating in Canada under IFRS, and the one in the U.S., they are under U.S. GAAP, so they need to convert. And under U.S., the regulator have approved a different method for depreciation, which is called the ASL, the Average Service Life method, which we believe is not acceptable under IFRS, so they need to move to a different method, which is called the ELG, but that's as a detail. So it is so fundamental for them, so that means it's like the entire business is a different model. So they said for them it's impossible to track the differences, you know, in the separate line. So it should be, you know, whatever the regulator allows you to recover, you know, or the method should be the best one. So that's the only one, because that conversion.
Dwayne? I guess first, Jane, to your original question, certainly plant balances, we do not use the 15-year life. I mean, once you are allowed recovery through depreciation of a portion of that original cost, that's pretty high confidence that you're getting that recovered, you're being allowed recovery. And in the States, they have a concept of original cost type audits, and if you have a major increase to your rate base or your plant, it goes through a lot of scrutiny, and then once it's approved, you know, you assume it's approved. To Michelle's point on the separate accounts, in the U.S., we still do have embedded reg assets that are simply called PP&E, as you've pointed out. And I haven't gone through the details, so the devil's in the detail, I realize, but you know, years ago, the SEC required us to break out rent liabilities for removal costs that we are collecting in advance of actually retiring and spending the money to retire, and we have a rent liability for that now. It used to be netted against PP&E. So that's the other side of an equation where you have reg liabilities sitting in PP&E. We also have reg assets for capitalized overheads or the interest. That is different. Yep. But I don't. I guess, Michelle, I don't see if we had to break it out, we'd break it out. I guess I don't see it.
In Canada, we have over 100 entities that have no choice. They broke it down.
Yeah. So
but,
I mean,
but for the method between ASL and ELG, they said it's fundamental. We can't track it down.
I'm not sure. I'd have to get into detail. Because we use group method depreciation, we were able to break out removal costs. I think we'd be able to break out some estimate of the other. We just have never had to do that. But anyway, I don't know if that answered your question in the initial part.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm looking for is how common is it, I suppose, as well, for these differences to arise. So two parts of the question. The first one, I think you have answered, which is...
I think the answer to how common is it is very common.
I think the question
as to how material are they is quite variable depending on the nature. So I mean, AFUDC versus interest, you'll find in every single one. Quite often the employee costs, if you've got direct costs you're allowed to recover, level pension cost recovery, for example, can vary. So those tend to be the things. I mean, the basic core PP&E cost is exactly the same. It tends to be the stuff which is the sort of pop up to that related to funding or overheads or internal costs that you've incurred in the course of construction effectively, and how much of that would necessarily happen.
How often, again, if you can answer this, would there be a different useful economic life, which I think was Michelle's example, where the pattern for depreciation would differ for regulatory purposes versus statutory accounting purposes?
In our case, we made them exactly the same. We did have to use different rates. So we had a different rate for regulatory purposes than we had for standard purpose for reporting purposes, but the amounts that came out at the end of the day were exactly the same. The amount of depreciation was exactly the same, but the starting point is different because there are certain rules that you have to follow from a regulatory perspective. So if you sell a business from one to another. The starting point is different. You have to go all the way down to, instead of calculating gross book value and the accumulated depreciation, the gross book value now becomes the old net book value, and there is no accumulated depreciation. That's for regulatory purposes. So there can be differences between those numbers and the numbers that you're using to do your financial reporting.
I remember the fact pattern for my entity. It's a gas company, and the issue is that whether it's difficult or not, in their case, there are two entities in the U.S. that they're not controlling. They have a 40% investment in it, and as a result, the other party says, "I am not going to provide that for you." You know, that reconciliation. So as a result, my client said, "I can't make it." I said, allow me to do it. No, I said, no, if you don't convert, we'll qualify. They said, okay, they went to US GAAP. So now they move on to US GAAP. Because it's not that they didn't want to do it, but they couldn't do it because they couldn't control the entity.
They couldn't get the information.
They wanted to control it.
Yeah, we've not had instances where there are differences. The methodologies used by the rate regulators are essentially consistent with what you would use under GAAP in terms of, you know, what the regulators are using is a very appropriate way to think about it under GAAP too, so there really aren't, we kind of account for it the same, but we always have to step back, is what the regulator is doing, is that appropriate under GAAP, and they always have been.
My experience has been that, you know, what you tend to see in the U.S. is formal engineering studies, depreciation studies, they're
right,
looking
yes.
at yep. you know, the life of plant, and the regulator yep. will look at that for the purposes of setting rates. So you've actually got, which we wouldn't see in the UK because you don't get direct recovery of depreciation, you get a revenue recovery. So we don't have the same level of actual information that you would have, which is you know, an independent engineer reviewing the plant, you know, the cost of maintenance, the performance, what the life might be, and actually basically setting it, and then that flows through to.
Excellent. Thank you. Mary?
Well,
earlier, I think we kind of moved from uncertainty to understanding why differences arise and kind of therefore what kind of inherent uncertainty, you know, that there might be about those differences. But I guess I wanted to check that we have consistency across all the experiences that we, you know, we have at the table today. Is the message I've taken away so far is, in terms of uncertainty and specifically demand risk, it really is relevant only in terms of the recovery period, you know, and in kind of the short term, demand risk is not a big factor, and it comes into the recovery period, especially when you have very long recovery periods, and that might be most relevant for long-lived, fixed assets. That's one message I took away, and that the, you know, in response to the basic question about what are the types of uncertainties you encounter, how do you deal with them, and I don't know if this is maybe a North American, Canadian, and U.S. in particular, the biggest type of uncertainty is determination about whether costs that have been incurred have been prudently incurred. So that's really not so much is it the right activity and allowed activity, it's have you done it in a way that is prudent, considering that aspect of the regulation. And so there might be some disputes about the magnitude, that, you know, that's more likely to be the point of contention than the activity. And so the, you know, first of all, is that what other people heard? And second, if it's what we heard, I think largely people talking about North American experiences, is that, you know, are there any different experiences from other jurisdictions?
So just, I mean, on the prudently incurred one, I mean, the kind of scenario, to maybe set a scenario which asks slightly different questions, is, you know, if you've got a storm and you need to go out and fix the lines, right, then the question is going to be, did you do that in the circumstance as prudent a way as possible, right? But you have to bring people back online at a certain time, pull people in.
And so you have the, in the UK setting, you would also have
the UK. The UK is a bit different. So I'm talking about some US examples that I've seen. If, for example, you had a major outage at a power station, and you're in a rate-regulated environment, and because of that major outage, you know, you had to go and, you know, buy power costs on market, which is significantly more expensive, then what you would maybe be doing is you'd be going looking for recovery. One of the questions that might be asked is, where you maintain that power plant properly in the first place. It's not about whether the costs of the event were prudently incurred. The question is whether you were doing your job properly in the first place and actually running the plant in accordance with industry standards, mm-hmm. and maintaining it in a way that outage, you know, generally was a catastrophic event as opposed to something which arose as a result of your negligence in effect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's slightly...
There are times when the question about prudence could be around the activity,
as opposed to
around the amount.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. An example of that was we were building a transmission facility, and the original estimated cost was less than $100 million. And the actual cost turned out to be closer to $1 billion. And so, of course, everybody went nuts about this thing. There was a special review into this.
No surprise.
So just one piece of it, though, to get back to what Michael was just talking about, was part of the construction was on Native Indian land. And so what they did was they built barricades on the land to stop our people getting onto the site where they had to go and build the lines. So what we did was we went out and we hired helicopters to fly the material over the top of the barricades and bring it out to the place, to the sites where the actual construction was taking place. So the question then became, was that a prudent thing to do? Because the cost was three or four times as much as it would have cost to truck it into the sites. And we had to defend that in the whole review of the cost. And at the end, the regulator decided that it was a prudent thing to do, and they allowed us to recover those costs. And we actually were very successful in recovering most of the... And there's a whole bunch of history, and I won't get into all the details about what happened with this thing. But let's just say it took a long time. This is about a 10-year process from the time that the first estimate was done to the time that the line was built and the review took place. But there is an example of where you can't go back to any previous history that you've had, but you've got to make your mind up as to whether you, first of all, feel it was a prudent thing to do, and then secondly, will someone who's a disinterested observer think that it was also a prudent thing to do?
Phil?
Yeah, just one additional observation, I guess, from a UK context, just thinking about capital expenditure and recovery and assessment of prudent expenditure. I guess the way the regulatory mechanisms work in the UK, so for example, TOTEX, because it's a pain-gain sharing mechanism, effectively, the company doesn't recover all its costs. If it overspends, effectively it recovers a part of those costs. So from that perspective, probably isn't the same sort of focus on the prudently incurred nature of the costs as a consequence.
Thank you. Dwayne?
The only other comment I was going to make, Mary, to your opening part of your question, and I think Michelle handled this earlier, but the concept of future demand is for, in the U.S. at least, as Michelle mentioned, under 980, that's a scoping question whether any of this applies to you at all. You have to, part of the scope of being under 980. So that is kind of a more global question than specific to each individual.
But once you decide the activity is in, right, it sounds like the only residual demand risk comes into the issue of, your 15-year cutoff for non-PP&E.
My 15-year is more about how can you know a future commission, which is going to be completely different people, will still allow something that the current commission allows, not as much about will we have the franchise with demand. We are assuming, and while we're under 71 for rate base as well, we assume we have the franchise and we have the customer base. It's more about can you politically rely on something one commission tells you today, and that's still going to be what they tell you 15 years from now. That's more what our uncertainty is, as I was thinking about it. It's not as much demand risk.
Harry, go ahead.
And just if you don't mind me trying to use the remaining time, there was one detailed question that we started to touch on earlier, and that's the estimation when you have cap and floor, et cetera. And I think Daryl, it was his four-part question. He said, it seems to be an on-off switch, 100% if you're over, in your case, 75%, there's uncertainty, and zero if you're under 75%, recognizing that there's not it's a judgmental determination of what the probability is. Does anybody have either a general practice or a practice in respect of a certain type of activity where you might use, say, an expected value, some kind of probability-weighted measurement when there is uncertainty, let's say uncertainty about whether what proportion of the cost would be deemed prudent, or I'm making this up. I don't know. But does anybody have anything other than an on-off switch for crossing the threshold that you might bake into some of the measurement of uncertainty? And if so, what is it?
I think we have the example which is I've got 75% of chance of, but I believe I can set it up. Sometimes you say, I will not set up $100, I will not set up 75 of 100, but I will say, I think I can recover something, but I can only recover 40 or 60 or 70. But I've got 75% of certainty I'm going to recover 60 of my 100 costs incurred. So they will not try to recover fully the amount that they could.
They will not recognize.
The full amount that they could. They might do it in their regulatory books, but not on their, statutory books.
And is it a kind of conscious and considered methodology, like expected value, assigning probabilities to different outcomes, or is it kind of an instinctive version of that? Let me recognize the amount that I have. At least, let me use your example of 75% probability. I know that under all the scenarios, I'll recover at least 45.
Yeah.
So I'm going to recover
in 45. It's going to be the exception, I would say. You know, if I big, I don't know, I'll give an example, and a big overrun, I said, well, maybe I'll be able to pass a few of the, a bit of the overrun, but maybe the entire overrun or... Yeah. But it's going to be the exception. You know, the majority of the time is going to be 75, I'm in, I book the whole amount, or otherwise I don't book it.
So generally, an absolute on-off switch,
sometimes
you're trying to estimate what the outcome is, with more or less specific methodology.
Sorry, it just sounded like it was more of a kind of expected or most likely outcome type approach, not a mechanical weighted average cost of risks or whatever, but more of
I'm not sure whether they will always take the most they expected. Will they take an average, you know, in certain others? I don't know. But they're rare cases, but I've seen it.
Based on your actual experience, is this your most likely estimate look to reasonable? Yeah, there was no big problem.
Well, there was a paper prepared by the Accounting Standard Board that was presented, I think, last year in October or September. They made a research on how many of those negative assets that are recorded are written off, and it was that big, you know, almost none. So when it's booked, you believe you're going to recover it. You might recover more, but you're going to recover at least what has been booked. Very, very rare that we have write-off.
It raises a bit of question, which I guess a lot of the time in these things are either very, very certain, so very close to 100%, or at the 50% level kind of thing, there's a lot of uncertainty. So when you book something, it's not 75% really. It's mostly 95 or 99%.
But I think what companies will do is to try and reduce the uncertainty through discussion with the regulator.
Sorry.
You know, you have those scenarios where you've got precedent.
Sorry, all the microphones are on.
I think you know, one of the things here is a number of people described the process that you go through. There will be scenarios where it's very, very clear you can expect some to get back because there's precedent. In cases where numbers are big and there's uncertainty, there's constant dialogue with the regulators, and therefore judgment which is made is not made in a closed room in isolation. It's made through discussion. Indeed, if it's really big, you know, people are going in and trying to get that certainty around recovery very, very quickly. So you know, to your question, the chances are you're never necessarily dealing with a huge level of uncertainty because you're not doing without at least having had a dialogue with the regulator, or you've got some knowledge of precedent as to how things have been treated in the past by your commissioner.
Can I give an example?
Let me bring Lily.
Yes. I would like to add an example from another jurisdiction an example to when there is an uncertainty and not because of a storm or something like that. When you exceed the budget, when you create a new project and you exceed the budget, you not always know if the regulator will compensate you for the lag between the budget and the accurate and the costs that occur. So you have to make an estimation about what will be the decision of the regulator. And this is another example, and it's not according to a storm or something like that. And then we usually take the 70-75%, which is according to the IFRS 14 and the way that we used to behave according to the US GAAP before IFRS 14. So this is how we do it.
Thank you, Lily.
Thank you.
Michelle, there was a storm. I think it's about 4 or 5 years ago in Ontario, and I told you we have 70 distributors, so everybody has his own area of distribution, and there was maybe about 20 entities affected by that storm. And some entities, they said, they incurred, you know, $10 million to repair it, but I made so much money this year because of the volume. It was a cold winter, and there's no true-up for volume. They said,
I've done enough. I'm not going to ask for recovering my storm cost. I'll do I can, but I'm not going to do it. Others says no. In my case, I've decided I'm going to do it, even if I've done too much money. So it was all over the place. But whoever put an application got their cost recovered, and the ones, you know, they didn't want to recover it, they just, you know, expensive. Just to say that for exactly the same case, you know.
Yeah. But I guess just a closing remark before going for lunch and some for maybe Dennis for breakfast. I guess that's because they have the right, so they consciously decided not to exercise the right.
Correct.
But all of that. My take is that everything is very clearly stated in the regulatory agreement, and this is the only way to be binding to both parts.
Definitely.
So how you are going to process the agreement depends on very much on the jurisdiction, but it should be clear there. Definitely. So with that, I think we, not we, but you as a group did great so far. Exactly, quite the best one. We have, for the ones who are in London, of course, we have lunch served in the kitchen, and we'll be back in 45 minutes. In particular, this for the ones who are attending by video. We will resume at 2 p.m. London time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, they automatically, I think, they stop the
broadcast.
Yeah, the broadcast.